Welcome to Keeping Up with the Constitution.
I'm here with the great and powerful Mr. Vince Tan.
Hi, nice to meet you, Victor. Welcome. Hi, everyone.
Welcome, Mr. Vince, to the podcast. So we just want to get you, I just want to ask you, what's your opinion? Because today is a momentous day for the judiciary, Najib's SRC application. So do you have any opinions about that?
I think we are looking at the strongest ever judiciary in the history of Malaysia, brave in their decisions. You look at some of the judgments, they are written very sound. Ideally, this is what the Malaysian judiciary should be. And I think we are slowly recovering from the 1988 judicial crisis and the political situation involving Malaysia. Right now, the multi-party system, it's actually working in the sense that you don't know who's going to form the next government. And everyone will be competing to get popular vote or popular support. And there will be check and balance, more demand of good governments. And as a result, we will see ultimately institutions being improved. And of course, the judiciary being an independent institution on its own should have its independence respected. And that is a very crucial part or pillar of the rule of law. So of course, this is just one of what you just mentioned. This morning's case is just part and parcel of a long episode or long saga in Malaysian politics. There will be many more other interesting cases to come, where as observers, you will never be bored to see or read Malaysian politics and also the development of the law when it comes to cases involving politicians.
Yeah, I like how you said like it's the strongest judiciary ever. So what do you actually mean by that?
I think throughout the years, you see the 1998 judicial crisis and the road to recovery to today. I think things started to be better off in 2008, because for the first time we see the ruling government, the executive, doesn't have a two-third majority in parliament. And and you look at decisions that was decided post-2008 in cases like Siva Rasa Rasia, in cases of Mohamed Hilman Idam against government of Malaysia, there's a lot of judicial activism that is going on, where in Mohamed Hilman's case, you see Section 15 of the then University Colleges Act being struck down as unconstitutional, which before this, it's very rare you see the courts striking out a legislation or provision of a legislation passed by Parliament. And it's been, I think, a decade more from Mohamed Hilman's case until now, the Court of Appeals decision. And along the way, we see many landmark decisions. I think in recent times, Semenya Jaya, which of course emphasized the need of the independence of judiciary as a very what we call the basic structure of the federal constitution. And of course, it debates all the rights on the narrative of the 1998 constitutional amendment to Article 121 of the federal constitution. So we see the decade of growth or the changes in the writing, the decisions of by the judiciary. And post Semenya Jaya, there are many other authorities which show that judicial activism is very much a trend now in Malaysia. And if a human rights lawyer were to file a case on behalf of his client, a public interest case, there is a higher probability of his case being decided with merits, and it's the arguments being appreciated rather than being given a conservative interpretation. And that's rightly so. This position is because constitutional provisions are to be interpreted as liberal as possible when it comes to fundamental liberties. And I think the current interpretation of fundamental liberties under the federal constitution being liberal and wide is the proper interpretation. And you have authorities like Tan Teck Seng, Lee Kuan Yew, which laid the foundations, and is very much appreciated now. By the courts, those authorities are often used in many federal court decisions in recent time.
So, Mr. Vince, what kind of lawyer are you? Because our new, I had the dean's briefing this morning, and our dean was quite sad that none of the students nowadays want to become a maritime lawyer like him, because everyone wants to change. Everyone wants to change the world. I want to be a criminal lawyer. I want to be a human rights lawyer. So, what work do you do?
I see myself nowadays being a lawyer in transition. I'm moving more to corporate practice, doing corporate advisory work and corporate litigation. I traditionally started off as a human rights work, a lawyer, criminal lawyer, and also an employment or industrial relations lawyer, which is very much rights-based. And along the way, we just see that there are a lot of things that we can do for society in our world, but however, sustainability on part of lawyers is also an issue. I think you might come across that many lawyers, young lawyers, they are complaining of bad pay, pupils being paid very badly. So of course, sustainability is an issue. So along the years, you will see a lawyer maturing and moving to different areas of practice so that his practice areas become more relevant and sustainable to enough to cover for his own expenses, the firm's expenses, revenue, and also to grow practice so that they can continue to serve more or more people in their capacity as lawyers. So that's why my recent transition to corporate law is so that practice becomes more sustainable. And of course, that's how I see myself recently. We are doing more corporate work, corporate advisory, engaging with more people, because we understand that the business community or companies, a lot of things happen during transactions and or how they operate businesses, which affect society. And sometimes these effects are adverse in nature. So as corporate lawyers, we help to mitigate those effects. And there's a booming area called ESG, Environmental Social Governance, where reporting of corporate companies on what they have done to improve their business practices to mitigate or reduce the harmful effects towards society, and what they do to make things better through the operations of business. Of course, it's part and parcel of the bigger context of or the framework of business and human rights, where if you want to protect human rights, you can't just talk about politics or public policy or society at large per se. You have to engage with the stakeholders. And many corporations are, like it or not, they are responsible for creating adverse effects towards society, and by therefore violation of human rights happen. And if you can help the companies to mitigate such adverse effects or such risks towards that are harmful towards society, you are doing your job to make the much better, doing your job to make the world a much better place. At the same time, being sustainable yourself. So all this is part and parcel of the Sustainable Development Goals (SDG). Yeah.
I'd like to take a step back into, instead of like the world now looking at you as a lawyer itself. I met a professor. His name is Professor John Lee from Hong Kong. Mm. He told me that when you start working, your job is mostly just to chase numbers. How true do you think that is?
I think that becomes a KPI, because when I talk about numbers, it's figures or revenue, income, KPI, because these are certain standards which a business organization would set up for its personnel. So for instance, law firms, law firm partners or the managing partners would set down standards or KPIs, key performance indicators for the staff or the other lawyers to perform, and it helps promote sustainability to a certain extent. And we live in a very competitive world, a corporate world. Therefore, it's part of the rat race or the chasing, climbing the corporate ladder. Some people are comfortable with it, and therefore they move up along the ranks. Some people, they find it too fast, and therefore they take a back seat by associating themselves with a less fast-paced institution or firm, which allow them to balance up their time, work-life balance, we call it. So it's a matter of choice at the end of the day. Yeah. So at the end of the day, it's what makes you happy.
So growing up in Penang, Mr. Vince, were you from Chung Ling High School?
On the contrary, I'm actually from St. Xavier's Institution.
Oh, okay.
I know Chung Ling is a very famous school in Penang, and also I heard they have a very powerful alumni as well. very good for networking and all that. So yeah, growing up in Penang, St. Xavier's, that gave me the privilege of being English speaking, and which helps me a lot in my daily tasks every day, communicating with people, doing networking, and it really smooths things a lot. But of course, the world is changing, and of course, the challenges of tomorrow is very much different than today. We're becoming more and more globalized world altogether, and the mastery of different languages actually helps you to engage with people from different community even more, especially in this globalized era that we live in. And our meeting here today by way of Microsoft Teams is a indication that we are moving towards a new type of era where people can meet despite the distance virtually, and things get going, especially the learning from the lessons from the pandemic. And I'm really excited to see what further technological advancement that we may see in the near future, especially on artificial intelligence, AI.
So I grew up with a lot of children around me, and none of the children I grew up with wanted to be like, you know what, when I grow up, I want to be a human rights lawyer, I want to be a corporate lawyer. So how did that transition from you being from St. Xavier until where you are now?
Okay, there is a story. I actually didn't really know what I wanted to do in Form 6. I just followed my friends. Three of my friends, probably among me, two of them wanted to become lawyers. So I just follow along the journey and all that. But I actually took my STPM, and I got the results that I needed to enter into a public university where my other peers did not. So one of them actually took private university, and another actually became he went to work with the church. The other friend, I'm so sorry to say that in recent years he passed on earlier. I consider myself living from a borrowed dream, and apparently that's how fate turns out. And probably like what other senior lawyers would say, practice is actually a calling, where you are somehow chosen, or you have a feel for it, and you fit in, and you continue to do what you do. But I'm going to be a bit honest that there's a price to pay being a lawyer, because it's not easy. Some people might just think that lawyers, they earn well, they live a happy life, and it's actually rather contrary, because it's actually very challenging physically, emotionally, and mentally. And these are often the challenges of litigation lawyers, because you deal with those problems, their mental stress as well, and you help them come up with solutions to your problems. And actually, when you go into court, it's like them taking a gamble or a risk to enforce or fight to defend their own interests or rights. So of course, the boiling plate is the lawyer, where we're always in that sauna where we have to deal with those type of cases, which a lot is on the line, especially for the client. But we learn to distance ourselves in a way so that we are protected or from being too much involved in the client's emotions or interests, and we are able to act professionally. So yeah, I think the transition, what I was then, now is totally unexpected. Yeah.
I think I asked Abraham the same question when I asked him about how did he feel when the Court of Appeal decided to reject the citizenship plea of the mothers, and did he actually feel like he failed the mothers? How do you feel? And like, let's say, I don't know, I'm not saying like if you lose a case, like how would you actually feel?
Of course, so far we have good quality control system in our firm where the younger lawyers would do the work, and of course it's vetted by the partners of the firm. So that gives a certain element of quality control. We know whatever we send out there, or when we go to the court as our battlefield, we've done what is needed already, and the rest are actually beyond us, how the court decides the decision, how the reasoning that is used by the judge or the judges on the panel. So human rights work is always a long journey. You will have your wins, you will have your lose, and even not just human rights case, even normal case as well. Well, you just keep going forward. That's why there's two rounds of further appeal. You started at High Court, you can appeal to the Court of Appeal, and later on to the Federal Court. You to play the game. So it's not all bad if you didn't get what you want in the court of first instance. You still have two chances to try again. And of course, it can be morally, or how do I put it? It can disturb your morale in the sense that if three suits or three rounds all the way, you didn't get the decision in your favor, but life moves on. You still have other clients to do work for, other cases you need to do. It's just about moving forward at the end of the day. Yeah.
So let's move on to the topic of fundamental liberties. I think most of my friends in school, all of us want to change the world, become constitutional experts. So,
am I audible and can you see me? Because your graphics is a bit blurred.
Yeah, it was a bit blurred just now, but I think the audio should be fine.
Right. If you want better connection, probably I can just turn off my camera and I use audio, and you let me know if you can hear and see me.
All right.
We can do away with the. Is this podcast requiring?
No, it isn't.
Pictures. Just voice. So okay, I'll turn off the camera. Hopefully, right. We have better connection.
Okay.
All right, Victor, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, yeah, you can ask your question straight away. I'll try my best to answer them.
So, speaking about the Women's March that happened recently, do you agree with what the Women's March stands for?
Well, I think it's not something that is one-off, you see. I think in previous time, I think me and my former colleagues actually participated in Women March before, because it's a call for gender equality, and as a participant or advocate of freedom of assembly, human rights, gender equality is something that you would stand for. Because discrimination, it does not just happen based on gender, it happens on many other platforms, such as discrimination on race, religion, economic background. And the Women's March actually stands for in the sense that women's rights should be more emphasized or looked at, because often and not traditionally there is a glass ceiling. My view to a certain extent is that glass ceiling has been broken, and we give credit to all the advocates for women's rights of the past for breaking those glass ceiling, but there are still many aspects of discrimination or inequalities that exist and faced by women in modern times. So I would take the position to respect freedom of assembly for what it is, freedom of speech for what it is, and of course, bearing in mind that there are restrictions. They are not supposed to assemble with arms, and of course not supposed to damage property and injure another person. But I think the women's march was fairly peaceful, you know. So I don't see an issue of it. Of course, when there are investigations towards the what you call organizers, I think it's just part and parcel of the protocol where police would still be do business as usual and open papers to investigate any rallies that take place.
You don't see a problem. However, Perikatan National Kuantan MP Wan Razali Wan Nors claimed that the march had been organized by LGBT groups, which was then struck down by the Tuan Speaker. But how do you feel about these members in Parliament having problem with these marches?
I think it's a political issue at the end of the day. Politicians from both sides, or three sides now, as you call it, would try to capture popular vote by capitalizing on issues. And LGBT community is just the issue, is just another issue to be taken advantage of for political purpose. Because there's a strong sense of conservative forces which reject the existence of LGBT community in Malaysia, and of course question marks exist is that, so if you reject the LGBT IQ community, what about right to life, which is guaranteed under the federal constitution? What about the Article 8, which in 2008, where there was constitution amendment to include gender? How do you define gender? Is it only the traditional male and female gender? Does it not include the third gender of LGBTIQ issues? At this juncture, there is no recognition yet of the third gender through the judicial process by the interpretation of the word gender in Article 8 of the federal constitution. But moving forward in and also in times and taking into recognition the developments of the world, all this, the rainbow movement and all that, certain things are here to stay. And it's just unfortunately that the whole rally was politicized in a way, highlighting the LGBT issue, which ultimately is just to stir up controversy in support to get support of certain communities towards those who raise those issues. So yeah.
Me growing up, it was always, how to say, I always had the sense from my elders that, you know what, some things are just out of hand, you know, like some people are just corrupt and it's just better for you to just quiet sit down, just upheld the status quo and don't be the hero lah. Don't try to change anything. Some things just cannot change, you know. Like, what do you feel? Well, like, my question to you would be like, what do you say to like people like this that want to change but they're more afraid of like the consequences? Like, exactly, like being investigated for hosting a women's rally must not be a nice feeling. Yeah.
Well, I remember my time when I was an undergraduate student. I faced the same kind of situation where my parents would be very concerned or very, they raised their objections towards my student activism on campus and also off campus. So, I think what really was the climax was the fact that I was participating in protests. It was the Tangkap Najib protest back in 2014 or 2015, if I recall correctly. That was the first time I got arrested. And of course, the reaction from my parents was, of course, they were empathetic and they understand that what I was doing, but they feel that I should not even have done it in the first place. But that was a controversy on the 1MDB issue that just popped up. Of course, my other juniors was also arrested later on in the Tangkap M1 rally. So those were incidents where was an eye opener for me as a student, because after you're being arrested, you got put inside lockup for 24 hours before being brought to the magistrate for a remand proceeding. I get to see lawyers like Ambiga Srinivasan, Gobind Singh, Dio, Eric Paulson, and Sivamala Ganapati being my lawyers and arguing a proper remand. So I get to learn remand firsthand. I think this is just the part and parcel of extra co-curricular activities that a student activist would do, and they learn up. That's why my exposure in university was not so much on in-campus activities, but it was the out-of-campus activities that gave me a different perspective of things. And also the network or the people I meet, it's actually a very good context, because some of them are actually now are very successful politicians or even business people who we keep in touch with. And actually, if you talk about career progression in whatever you do, networking is your net worth is your network. Your network is your net worth. So meeting people, getting know more people, or getting connected, that's just part and parcel of how the world is right nowadays. And I'm grateful for the activities that I participated in. But of course, the sense of fear is real. There's a real culture of fear. And sometimes standing up for others and not seeing others returning favor and standing up for you can be emotionally or mentally very stressful, or can even break you. Because that's why you see a lot of activists, they took a step back and stopped getting themselves involved in activism, because the lack of support. And I don't blame the older generation for trying to stop the young generation from speaking out, because they fear the repercussions of it. Because I see their where they're coming from at the end of the day is it worth it to face those challenges, or let's say being arrested and or taken disciplinary action in university and all that. But when you're young, you're idealistic. That isn't that what makes youth unique? Isn't that part of the learning process altogether? I do acknowledge the fact that when certain lecturers or academics, they say you should not be influenced by out external forces like political parties, politicians, or even NGOs, and then you get involved in all this activism, you should focus on your studies first and all that. There's no right and wrong answer, because you can study, but if you lack the passion of what you're studying, that is also not something that's right, right? So sometimes university students must be given a place to explore what they like and do what they like. This is part of self-actualization. Actually realize who you want to be and your true potential of what you want to be, and that can only be done by exploration, right? So although I do have certain regrets as a student activist back then, but I think if it wasn't for the experience that I had back then, the context I made right now, I would not be able to do business as usual of what I'm doing right here right now. So I guess this is just part and parcel of life. You just keep moving on, despite having one or two regrets, but you just keep moving on, and hopefully that you have a chance to make amends or do things better and continue to do good in whatever you do. So yeah.
So getting arrested was a good thing, Lagan?
I get to watch remand for free, la, right?
Maybe I should get arrested sometimes, huh?
Well, try not to. The food is not good as outside. So you we often take liberty for granted. So I actually remember my 3 days, two nights in Xinjiang stay. So after that, I started off a project, a football project, which promotes unity and anti-racism narrative. So it was joined by many of my friends from different political parties, even academics. Dr. Asmi Sharon was part of my football team, Edmund Bond, human rights lawyer, and many others. So that project was because we took certain small liberties for granted. For instance, going to the field to play football, having good food to eat and all that. And being in a student activist getting arrested really changed your perspective quite a bit and taught me not to take things so granted in life. I don't go off topic too much on that.
Yes, I'm enjoying
it's
myself.
Down memory lane.
So speaking about student activism, yesterday, University Technology Mara, UITM, warned its students again participating in a dialogue session featuring Syed Sadiq lah, and my friend Amar, if you're listening to this podcast, Amar, thank you for going out there and expressing us. Amar was there with Syed Sadiq last night when my friend Amar, then they barred them lah from entering UITM. So how do you feel about that? About like universities barring these people coming in to talk?
I think you have to look at the recent amendments to the University and University Colleges Act. It was amended in a few times, 2012 and then 2019. Those are steps taken to liberalize student participation in politics, activism, and all that. And the recent 2019 amendments is to allow students to organize political party activities within campus. If there is a legislative intent to liberalize practice or how to put it, the actual things that happen on the ground, I think universities ought to change their policies, internal regulations, in line with the Parent Act Amendment. University and University Colleges Act are a statute, right? It's an act of parliament. Then universities are empowered to do their own regulations and all that. And how decisions are made, whether to feature one speaker or another, these are decisions that are made internally. And ultimately, it has to be consistent with the legislative intent of the Parent Act. So what do I think is, I think it's since that Parliament has decided to liberalize student activism, participation in inside campus, I think the whole culture of banning one speaker to speak and all that has to be given liberalization as well. You know, you can't just simply ban speakers from speaking without good excuse, unless the speaker is inciting violence, inciting offenses to be committed, and is a dangerous person, then of course no. But someone who's like let's say Syed Sadiq, a former minister, is a member of parliament, and also a youth. I think he's still falling under the category of youth. So I think the harm that he can create, I don't think there's any real risk of him being a threat to public order or security. So they should just give him space to speak. And after all, that actually helps the university much better in a sense that you're creating a platform for people to get together and have meaningful conversations, and also attract people to come to the university and attend these type of talks. It's part and parcel of branding, you see. For instance, we're all from UM. UM's branding speaks for itself, and part and parcel of that is because UM's environment is more liberal, I would say, than others, and more acceptive of different views. And that is what academic freedom is all about. Not just freedom for students, but also academics to explore, research, think, teach, and also to expose students to different opinions. And ultimately, a person who is exposed to different views, different opinions, can make their own judgment of what is right and what is wrong. That's where the thinking process, the critical thinking process develops, when there's a thesis, there's an antithesis, and then you go have your synthesis by considering both views, and then you come up with your own opinion at the end of the day. That's very important for nation building and development. Yeah, I think I can see your face more clearly. Probably the connection's better. I'll turn on the camera to be in solidarity with you.
Thank you. So speaking about academician, would you mind shedding light on to our listeners about the case of Professor Azmi Sharam?
Dr. Azmi Sharam, right? All right, he taught me international human rights humanitarian law back in law school, undergraduate, and also conflict of law. I think it was after he got charged in court for under the Sedition Act, it's a reported case. And we all students, we did a campaign for him. I was a coordinator for this movement called Solidarity for Us, Michelle.
But moving back, how did he get charged with the Sedition Act?
It was a comment reported by Malay Mail, I think, pertaining to his comment on the Perak crisis, the Perak constitution crisis, on pertaining to appointment of the Menteri Besar of Perak, using that precedence to be applied in Selangor. So of course you all know the case of Mohammad Nizar against Zamri, Abdul Kadir. So that was pertaining to how you test a person's confidence in whether the person, the Menteri Besar, has confidence or not. So there was this publication on Malay Mail which Dr. Asmi quoted or used a reference in Perak saying that they should not be having a secret meeting and all that. So that was the line used in the case. And he was charged for that. And of course, there's also a reported case where the Sedition Act was challenged by Dr. Asmi Shell, went all the way to federal court and was held to be constitutional. So the details are in the case. I think for those who are interested, you can read up the case of public prosecutor against Dr. Asmi Shalom to get the context of that saga. Yeah. But I think what I wanted to share was more on the events that happened after he was charged, where us students was organizing ourselves. So we actually formed a coalition between academics and students called Solidarity for Asmi Shalom. So we did campaigns, we did a protest, we marched on campus to the main library where there's a tree. We all climbed up to that tree and gave speeches. That was a very memorable moment. And everyone was surrounding that tree. There was massive support for Dr. Asmi Shalom because it was an issue of academic freedom. He, being a lecturer of law, talking on a legal issue that was discussed as a current issue at that time, and he should not be taken criminal actions against, because that is, to a certain extent, is an attack on academic freedom. If academics are not allowed to talk or discuss on issues relating to their field of expertise, how are they going to teach students freely, you know? And also, how's that going to encourage critical thinking? And back then, Dr. Asmi Shah was not the only one being charged. There was others being investigated and also charged. So there was a sedition dragnet, and therefore there was it's part and parcel of creating a culture of self-censorship, which those was dark ages, 2014, 2015, a lot of arrests, a lot of events that happened. I think because that time the political struggle was real. And if you look at the 2013 general elections results and the 2018 general elections results, the 5 years gap, the competition was real to see who would win the next general election 2018. And we actually saw for the first time in our history, a change of federal government. So like it or not, I'm not sure whether the listeners likes politics or not, politics affect us in many different aspects, even in education and also the law, because the law provides a mechanism, a framework for how the country is run. And if certain politicians want to run it in another way than what it is right now, amendments of legislation, constitutional amendments need to take place before all that can, what they wish to see can actually manifest. So yeah, I hope that answered your question.
Then I would like to chime in with that, with your freedom of speech. So I think this case holds dear to your heart, the case of Mr. Superman Hugh and his comic book.
Yeah.
Do you mind enlightening our listeners to what is that case about?
So there was sometime in October 2019 where a book ban towards three comic book in different languages. So the comic book is called Belt and Road Initiative for Win-Winism. So it's published in English, Malay, and also Chinese. Of course, it was distributed nationwide, sold, and also in school. So the controversy actually started is when books were distributed in schools. All these are widely reported, so I can talk about it. So there's actually a case all the way to federal court. We filed a judicial review to squash the book ban by the Ministry of Home Affairs. We didn't succeed in the High Court. So we appealed to Court of Appeal and we won, right? Where the court was unanimous in nature that our appeal has merit and appeal was allowed. The government or the Ministry of Home Affairs subsequently filed an application for leave to appeal at the federal court, but their leave was not granted. Therefore, the Court of Appeal decision stands. So for those who are interested, you can read about the case of Hugh Kuan Yew against Menteri Dalam Negeri. It's a Court of Appeal decision which decided that pertaining to the book ban, that Section 7.1 of the Printing Presses and Publications Act 1984, where the minister exercised discretion to ban book publications on grounds of public order, security and all that. That discretion is not earned, although the wording there is absolute discretion. It doesn't mean that the minister has absolute discretion. It still can be questioned in the court of law pertaining to the exercise of the minister's power under that section. And if that case, what makes that case unique is that there's quite a high threshold to fulfill before banning a book, because in that case, Court of Appeal decisions held that 81 police reports and numerous social media comments were not enough to be a yardstick for the exercise of minister's discretion to ban a book. So the threshold is high, and the report by the Controls and Enforcement Division of the Ministry of Home Affairs was alleged to be relied on by the minister then, Tan Sri Muhyiddin Yassin, to come to that decision to ban the book. But that report by the Enforcement and Control Division was not adduced as affidavit evidence in the case. So all this cast doubt to the whether the minister's decision was reasonable in the first place. So of course, judicial review proceedings, you have to file the case based on the grounds of judicial review. Irrationality, unreasonableness, that being the first. Second, procedural impropriety. Third is, of course, illegality. And of course, the growing area or the growing grounds of disproportionate. Yeah, all these are part and parcel of administrative law. For those who love administrative law, you can read up on that case, and there are actually quite a number of good administrative law books being in the market in recent times. So yeah.
Okay. One last question before I let you leave. This morning you just had our dean's briefing. Then I saw a few of my friends go up on stage, got dean's list. Then yeah. I felt like a sense of do I actually belong here? The sense of the imposter syndrome, everyone is doing the XYZ and I'm only doing AB. Am I even on par on the level? Do I even belong here? Feel like an imposter? How do you feel getting over that?
Okay, I was my first year in university was the toughest time, and I think until today I won't consider myself being a good student, but I did enough just to graduate, and I'm quite happy for that, because all of us are born in different time, different place, different environment. So there will be differences in how each human being performance gauge and all that. But at the end of the day, it's about doing things that you're happy with. And if I were to take a look at my badge those who are doing litigation are not necessary lawyers with first class degrees, or those who are mooters, right? It's on the contrary, those who don't score as high marks are the ones doing litigation, and probably the ones with the good marks that are just doing corporate law in terms of merger acquisition, compliance work and all that. So it's a different ballgame altogether. So you have to ask what you want, what area of law you like, because in your 4 years in law school, you more or less will know what area of law you like. And if you want to venture into practice, more or less you have to start looking at firms which offer that area of law of practice, because that is how you want to build your career as a practicing lawyer. There are numerous options now. You don't only just because you graduate from law school doesn't mean you have to be a lawyer. There is career options or opportunities like being an in-house lawyer, where you work with a company and in their legal department. There are also opportunities with organizations, NGOs, and also other international bodies as well. Then, of course, the route of being an academic, where you have to later further on your studies as in master's and also your PhD and become an academic in a public university or private university. There are many options, and there's also a growing area of policy work within companies. So for instance, social media companies like Facebook, TikTok, Instagram, all them, they are using policies being introduced by in those apps and all that. So it's legal, there's a demand for legal graduates to work in those type of areas as well. And also another area would be political risk and governance. So for those who are interested in politics or even governance, there's actually a booming area in corporate a sector where corporate, they engage certain officials with this portfolio to educate those companies, especially foreign companies, on the what's going on in this country in terms of politics and governance, so that they can manage their risks accordingly. Because when you try to cater products or services which for into a new region, or you need to be sensitive of the demand or and supply of that community which you want to market your products to. So yeah, there's the world is your oyster. So you can of course have many options ahead. Yeah.
Oh, once again, I would like to thank Mr. Vince for joining us on our podcast. Thank you so much, Mr. Vince.
Welcome. Always a pleasure.